Hello, this is Informer, a show that reveals the latest ideas from artists, thinkers, and technologists. Informer invites you behind the screen to meet the people sketching, hacking, and imagining the next versions of our world. I'm Roddy Schrock, your host, and in each episode, I spotlight creative minds grappling with a changing world through art, technology, or often both. And I hope you'll subscribe to this podcast at informerpodcast.com, where you can also find show notes, links, and more information on all of the artists and projects that we discuss. Bea Covington, a multimodal sound artist whose work is as formally challenging as it is joyfully satisfying, was recently in New York and sat down for a conversation with me at my office here in Brooklyn. I enjoyed our time so much, and it's the first episode of Informer that was recorded in person. We began our conversation by talking about the radical work of the Public Television Workshop, creators of Sesame Street, and the influence that group and that show had on Bea's practice. Our rollicking, wide-ranging conversation then took us to many places, including their contemplation of the media's framing of the relationship between Michael Jackson and his sister LaToya, and how that might act as an inspiration for Bea in their new composition. I also enjoyed their thinking about ways we might work more closely with AI as a creative force. Speaking of AI, I think of this conversation as part three in my AI Personhood series that began with an interview with Kay Alotto McDowell, followed by a conversation with James Bridle. I encourage you to check those both out if you haven't already. I hope you enjoy this fun conversation, and happy Pride from all of us here in New York.
Yeah, so, and a lot of the stuff that I, you know, in hindsight, you know, it seems like a lot of the stuff that I think people like, you know, Jim Henson and Mr. Rogers, you know, we're doing, you know, really interesting kind of like public education. Yeah. And so for me, like, art and education come together. For me, art is, it has a lot to do with kind of like the kind of like the interest to kind of like push epistemologies forward, right? And like kind of pushing the limits of like what is possible. For me, art is, my background, like, formally, like, comes originally from like STEM. I guess it's STEAM now. I love that. But for me, when I was in school and stuff, I was really into like experimental design, and that definitely evolved into what is now my practice as a working artist.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting what you're saying, because I think that I've been thinking a little bit about this recently too. Like, when you think back to, it sounds funny to say, but I mean, I have memories of Sesame Street being like a really intense kind of learning experience for me as a child. And looking back on some of the ideas that were sort of being presented in today's landscape, they seem rather radical. And I don't really see, you know, the kind of that, as you said, like that kind of public notion of education and kind of learning as a radical act sort of approach. It feels absent to me in many ways, and even what was kind of like a second tier from that, perhaps, of people coming from that background and moving into, as you're saying, like Nickelodeon and so forth. It's sort of like those waters are just thinner and thinner, I feel like, as the years go by. But I'm curious about how that plays into your practice. How do people phenomenologically engage with your work?
Yeah, so I'm definitely a sound artist, like sound. And like, for me, sound is definitely more an enjoyment of its status as a container to acoustics, a sister to phenomenology, than it is a mother to music.
I love that. Right. Yeah. Can you say more?
Yeah. And like, my practice involves music composition for sure. I've done, you know, my share of that. And there's more to do. But for me, mostly, I'm really interested in, as a step one, I think this idea that comes from physics, which is like the basically free vibration and forced vibration. I'm really interested in, I definitely had like a spill where I was like reading like a lot of, like, I think a lot of people did, like reading like, in like the early mid 2010s, like reading a lot of emergence theory. Just kind of getting into sonics as an expression of phenomenology. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where are those similarities in your practice around, say, like education or kind of public learning or?
Yeah, no, it's clearer than I realized. Wow. Thanks for asking that question. So part of my frustration, because I definitely like began my practice out of frustration. I was in a really hard like life spot for a young kid, and like basically I was really kind of disillusioned with like the education that I was getting. Mm-hmm. In ways, there were a lot of class barriers that I faced like in my education. And so I was kind of also like asking a lot of questions like for myself with regards to kind of the matter of like being an autodidact, mm-hmm. right? Like kind of taking materials in and like curating your own experiences. Mm-hmm. And like, I think that I was really interested when I first started making electronic sound, because I mean, I had a background like in string instruments for a while before mm-hmm. that. I definitely would say that like at like when I started with making electronic sounds, I was really interested in. I was fresh off of reading like Anselm Franck's like curatorial text Animism, mm-hmm. and I was like really into this idea of like talismanic media that kind of like produces calls to action, mm-hmm. right? And like, so though, when it comes back to those early memories, like I think the Sesame Streets of the world, less so Nickelodeon. Nickelodeon was really weird. They had a very interesting shakeup when I was growing up in the 2000s, mm-hmm. in the tone and character of what they were trying to do, mm-hmm. and the quality of the content that they were offering. But in any case, I do find that I started definitely with an interest in trying to produce as much of like a somatic experience that allows yeah. people hmm. to move differently mm-hmm. after having kind of like felt the sound work that I yeah. generated yeah. with yeah. electronic sounds, which are digital sounds.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's a whole other thing kind of that I had to kind of get into. Like, I think like foundationally, like what is digital media? and I really had to get into I think digitality not being something that's like part of, not necessarily limited to the prior past, you know, 50 years, you know, 60 years now, I guess we're in the 2020s, but like long before I think contemporary articulation of like mm-hmm. I think the digital did. And I think that, and I really am someone who really believes contemporaneity began 500 years ago.
I mean, I feel like one of the things that I love every time I talk to you is that I feel like the things that you point to in your practice and the way that you talk about your practice, it's really raising this kind of rich set of questions around even how we define the kind of media world that we live in, the kind of sonic world that we live in. Even as you're saying, just like ideas of what actually is contemporary, where do those lines get drawn? And I find joy in the kinds of questions that your practice even is raising, you know, for me in this conversation.
I think that ultimately the goal is to be able to, because again, like my background originally was in STEM, mm-hmm. and I found like a lot of frustration there mm-hmm. in not being able to ask questions that don't necessarily come with research inquiries that right. are contained to the prior 80 years. I didn't like, actually, I don't know, the kind of flippant attitude, kind of like assuming that you're not as serious. Practitioner, whatever your field, if you're sourcing materials like seriously that mm-hmm. come before, I think, the atomic age. And so, like, that's definitely where I began my art yeah. artistic practice.
I get it.
I do have like a concrete method. Mm-hmm. I'm really interested in like throwing paint mm-hmm. at walls. Mm-hmm. Seeing what works. Like, there's that phenomenon of, like, pareidolia, you know, that, like, I think a lot of cognitive scientists okay. like to talk about, where, like, you'll see images out of nonsensical or nonlinear data, right?
Right, okay.
It's almost like a dietary thing. Like, I'll take in whatever I take in my life, and then I'll have my like explosion moment, mm-hmm. and then like I'll read what happens, and I'll cut the fat, and then I choose a new wall.
So you're in New York, and you're here shooting video for funding a project that you're currently working on. What are you working on right now, and where does this video kind of play into?
So, like they say, I'm really lucky to have had a working relationship with Jeremy Bailey. Part of what Jeremy communicated to me is like how important it is when you're attempting to not only communicate a message, but as well when you're attempting to put together like a structure mm-hmm. to like make sure that it, you know, is easy,
right. yeah,
easy
yeah.
to access.
Yeah,
your content, you know, your effort will be 2,000% more successful if there's video content. So basically, myself and a couple of other artists have come together and formed an immersive cinema DAO.
Amazing. That's amazing. Okay.
And we have the crackpot goal of basically producing. So we have a twofold goal that kind of comes together into one aim. And I'll talk mm-hmm. about the twofold goal
because yeah.
it's
okay.
the most funny part.
Okay.
So, like, we're interested mm-hmm. in producing a pitch for the film Rat Race 2. Which sounds like what? But the, like, it's just silly.
Oh,
it's so
God.
Silly.
Yeah.
But like, I'm so serious.
I believe
we want to. We want to write Rat Race 2.
Okay.
Secondarily, there's a performance intervention that we're planning to do. Basically will serve to support the main point here. And the main point here is that we have developed a really useful word.
Yes, you were talking about this.
Yeah, yeah. A really yeah. useful word that leverages the relationship between social hostility and comedy, right? In a way that allows for, I think, our machines to have a different relationship with us.
Okay.
For the prior 20 years of Web 2, it, you know, we've had so much, you know, verbal metadata that kind of like is predicated upon this surveillance-based relationship wherein we are passive. And the idea here is to produce a word and a universe around this word that allows that relationship to shift and mm. to not necessarily be passive. Mm. so that, you know, we're now getting some really interesting, like, kind of like natural language to image, you know, interventions in artificial intelligence right now. And it is, you know, there's a lot of fear around, I think, the idea that machines can read us based off of all of the things that we say.
Yeah.
So why not just weaponize that transparency? And so that there is, you know, a really great symbiotic relationship between mm-hmm. us and our machines.
Yeah.
Because, you know, because of what we've done, they have lives too now. So it's like...
The machines.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Like, you know, there's like the really important like project that happened, you know, in the last few years, like Ian Chang, Bob, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When I was lucky enough to see Bob in person, and I was... that was definitely alive. That was a living thing. Sorry.
Yeah. No. I mean, it's so interesting you're saying this, because recently had two conversations with artists that are, I think, thinking along the same lines you are. I spoke to Kay Alato McDowell recently, who has a book called Pharmaco AI, which was co-written by GPT-3, an AI person that co-wrote the book with him, and was also speaking to James Bridle recently, who has a new book called Ways of Being. And the thesis of the whole book is kind of essentially what you're saying, that we have to develop new models for understanding our relationship to these machines, because in essence, they're beings. They're non-human beings, but how we choose to now start to live with those non-human beings determines not only their future, of course, but our future as humans. And really, the only way to go forward is to imagine them as persons of, you know, non-human or a non-corporeal necessarily kind of, you know, personhood. It's fascinating to hear that you're thinking along those same lines of developing, I guess, if I'm understanding, a kind of a new paradigm or a new language almost that, as you said, sort of, you know, weaponizes a radical transparency around those relationships.
Yeah, I definitely say it'd be a relationship where there's more agency for us.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And then, like, separately, I think it's... I love that you brought up, like, non-corporeal beingness,
mm-hmm.
right? That's something that I think in my own lane, I really... I think when I was first beginning, I think my sound practice, I was caring about a lot. I definitely, I was one of those folks who definitely had gotten into, you know, I don't know if I'll call it a trap. It's not a trap, necessarily. Yeah, it kind of is. Yeah, never mind.
It is a trap. I don't know what you're going to say, but...
of, like, kind of, like, thinking, like, in terms of, like, oh, we're humanity and we're moving toward post-humanity.
Right,
that singularity trap.
Yeah.
That's definitely a trap.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think what you're pointing to is just, I mean, and I couldn't agree with you more, just the sense that there was a vision for how human and technology beinghood was supposed to sort of come together. And if I'm hearing you correctly, you're sort of saying, like, well, actually that lane, that kind of road that we thought we were on is a trap. And it's, as you said, and maybe it's better to kind of reshuffle the deck.
I'm really interested in, like, this idea of, like a public narratology, like a public way of making narratives,
mm-hmm.
a public way of telling stories, a
mm-hmm.
public way of getting people to, interpret the rest of their reality. And the thing that is kind of cloaked in our culture, well, one of the things, because there are so many, but one of the things that's cloaked in our culture popularly is, and when I say popular, I mean like as in like populism, like popularly, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. is, you know, the matter of art being the literal bridge between the things that happen politically and the things that happen commercially.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
And for art, and like functionally within an economy, the role of artists within capitalism is mm-hmm. to produce equity from scratch, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. basically. And so, if there's been a freeze on that ability, it would make maybe a lot of this kind of weirdo like shift toward, I don't know, like the kind of like, I don't know, cultural kind of like precedents being like with entrepreneurs rather than, you know, with I guess folks, whether or not they're artists, but folks outside of, I think, who don't necessarily have like an ontological state within capitalism, mm-hmm. I'll say. Mm-hmm. It kind of makes that structure, that situation, way more fraught.
Yeah.
And it kind of puts people who are like running capital schemes into more of a position of power.
Yeah.
To basically to milk people, sort of. Right. Especially if you have the power to contract artists to make the media mm-hmm. that then frames the way that people digest and interact with the world mm-hmm. at large, mm-hmm. you know, that's inordinate. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things that, you know, again, I appreciate about your practice is I feel like you're trying to short circuit that system in the way that you create your work. What is the GoFundMe funding that you're...
Yeah, one sentence. Let me give it to you. So basically, we want to invent a word that develops a relationship and allows us agency in our relationship with our machines, primarily. And the word itself is one that leverages the other relationship between comedy and social hostility.
Uh-huh, got it. And does the word exist yet?
The word does exist.
Okay.
If we can fund, we will unveil the word.
I love it. Oh my god, that's so funny.
So we're holding a hostage, and you can see Rat Race 2.
Well, this is
maybe one day.
This is where I'm getting confused. This word.
All right. So Rat Race 2 was called Rat Race 1. Mm-hmm. Released August 17th, 2001.
Okay.
And Rat Race was called a masterpiece in American escapism. Why not just marry all of that mm-hmm. with a franchise that can actually carry our anxieties better and in a healthier way?
Okay.
So, yeah, we want to see Rat Race 2 and 3 and 4, 5, Cyan and 5, Magenta. Oh, and, like, we want to see it. And we want to, and also, I also think it would be really interesting, maybe, to, like, there are so many, like, producers of, like, comedy right now online who, like, really have, like, great audiences and who do really interesting work. But there just aren't enough opportunities.
And here
it
could
be really interesting one day, like, if you had, like, Rat Race 2 Cyan and Rat Race 2 Magenta and Rat Race 2... White. Like, 3 versions of Rat Race 2, all with different casts.
Oh my so, God.
I'm sorry, I'm clowning right now, but, like, I'm so serious.
I believe you. No, I mean, yeah. Well, and so, where do people go to support this project?
So we're going to be running it in June.
Okay, good.
We're going to be running this in June.
Just for 1 month, or?
We're just going to be running it in June, and we'll see where it goes.
Okay.
It can fail, and that's okay.
Yeah. Does it have a website?
No, there's no website that's available at the moment, but essentially, it'll be kind of released with some co-media, this crowdfund. That should be really fun and interesting. And the media that goes along with this crowdfund will be free.
Okay.
So, like, get into that.
Yeah, yeah. Where do people find information about this online if they want to, if they're listening to this in June?
Yeah, if you're listening to this in June, it'll be on Indiegogo. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. I feel like we went so many different directions. What are you working on now in your own practice? Like, what new do you have new sound pieces that you're developing? Do you have performances upcoming?
Or? Yeah, in terms of like work that I'm kind of developing, I'm kind of like always kind of working ambiently on a film that involves this church that I developed. The first film was called Thunderbolt Hum, and the Thunderbolt Hum revolves around this church called the Holy House of Christ and God Incorporated for Noir Wave. And so I am just kind of like ambiently making a film. I've been doing it for now a year and a half. And obviously, like, I wrote my album a couple of years ago now. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm always kind of rehashing and rehabbing those materials. So I will have an album of music composition to come out at some point. But and that one's, I'm really excited about it. It's like I'm writing it about the relationship. I mean, really, to put it succinctly, I'm writing it about the relationship between Michael Jackson and his sister LaToya Jackson.
Oh wow.
Around the turn of the millennium. And on one level, and then on another level, it's kind of like a way to understand this broader theme of paternalism. And that definitely shaped their relationship as it was documented publicly during that time.
Mm-hmm.
There was so much riffraff between the two of them where they would never actually speak physically, but they used media at distances to essentially speak to each other.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is really interesting
in hindsight
because... Yeah. There was always the notion that, like, Michael and LaToya were actually very close when they were growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Michael apparently, much like, I think, with the Jackson dynasty, like, there's, like, Janet and Randy who are really close. As well, Michael and LaToya were very close. And I find that interesting I don't know.
Yeah,
that relationship interesting the way it was documented. Obviously, I'm not a member of that family. I don't own anything. I'm just, you know, someone who watched what was documented in hindsight, it brought up some really interesting feelings and questions.
Mm-hmm. No, I hear you, and that's something that you'll release online.
That is to be discovered.
Yeah.
I have the material. I've made the material. I'm consistently working on it.
Mm-hmm.
There will be a time when I share it.
Mm-hmm.
And that time's not now.
Yeah. I get it. Yeah. Where do people find your work online?
Yeah. So there are a couple of places where my work is visible. So I am active on SoundCloud. I'm active on Bandcamp. I have a website called syzygy.tech, so syzygy.tech, syzygy.tech, where I kind of have posted some details from my film Thunderbolt Hum, and I'm also pretty active on Instagram right now, although I'm kind of like steadily peeling off, like I think, just because the zeitgeist has moved like off of there. But also I wish I was, you know, more serious about getting off of, like, social media. But sadly, I'm not immune.
Yeah, it's just, it's always a pleasure to just hear about your work and kind of learn what you're thinking about. Do you have any performances coming up? Will you be doing any sort of live work?
I've made the decision not to do anything unless this word happens. Mm-hmm. And if this word happens, I have a really fun show that I've planned. Like, my first music project that, like, kind of released sort of formally in 2016, like, I was doing something then that I'm still kind of doing, which is, like, this kind of, like, dimensional stereography, where I'm kind of, like, I think back then I was really into, like, kind of, like, theorizing, like, six-dimensional structures, and, like, trying to figure out, like, okay, like, using, like, I think, like, one-dimensional artifacts, how do we convey, like, these... It's like, because in mathematics, you have the tesseract, you know, that allows you to, like, kind of, like, represent different dimensionalities within, like, other lower realms of dimensionality. And so...
I mean, was this something you were exploring in sound?
Yeah.
Do you know the work of Joji Uwasa, a composer? He did a lot of electronic music, but also a lot of acoustic music that was very much a little bit what you're describing of, like, how do you make these multidimensional objects using sound in a way, and then how does that actually relate to the human body? Or how do you feel those shapes, you know, through sound? Wow. I'm just excited to see what you come up with next. It's good to see you. It's nice to be able to speak in person. And I'm still getting used to that, weirdly. I'm like, wait, what does it mean to actually talk to somebody?
Until next time, thanks for joining me at Informer, and I hope that you'll join us again.